nothing you could not do about life. Then you're the mosquito biting the iron bull. Well, so in the same way, he said, look, you heard a bomb coming at you. You could hear it whistle, and you knew it was right above you and headed straight at you, and that you were finished. And you accepted it. And suddenly, there was a strange feeling that everything is absolutely clear. You suddenly see that there isn't a grain of dust in the whole universe that's in the wrong place. That you understand completely, absolutely, totally, what it's all about. Because you can't say what it is. But he said in so many cases the bomb was a dud and they lived to tell the tale. Or he said you were in a concentration camp. You've been there so long that you gave up all hope whatsoever, ever getting out. You were just going through this miserable, boring, degrading grind, week after week after week. Nobody paid the slightest attention to you as an individual. You knew you would never get out, and you accepted it. And suddenly, something changed. This extraordinary feeling of freedom. Or he said, you were a displaced refugee. You had lost your family. You didn't know whether they even existed. You were miles from your home. You didn't know whether it existed. You had lost your job, your very identity. You were absolutely nowhere. And you accepted it. And suddenly, you were as light as a feather and free as the air. Now he said, so many people have had those experiences and they talk about them to their families and friends and they say, oh, well, you were under terrific pressure and you probably had some hallucination, you know? Well, he said, I am showing those people that so far from having a hallucination, those were the few occasions in which they woke up. So, you see, this is always the opportunity presented by death. That if one can go into death with eyes open and have somebody help you, if necessary, to give up before you die, this extraordinary thing can happen to you. So that from your standpoint, in that position at that time, you would say, I wouldn't have missed that opportunity for the world. Now I understand why we die. The reason we die is to give us the opportunity to understand what life's all about. By letting go. Because then we come to a situation that the ego can't deal with. When we are no longer hypnotized by that, then our natural consciousness can see clearly what all this universe is for. So, therefore, we have missed this golden opportunity by institutionalizing death out of the way, instead of having a socially understood acceptance of death and rejoicing in death. Now, I could imagine that one person would want to rejoice in death in an entirely different way from another. Like, say, a wedding is a rite of passage. There are certainly some forms of celebrating a wedding which I would find a total bore and quite offensive. Other ways would be very good. I would enjoy it. So everybody, in other words, I'm not saying that you've got to get mixed up with a lot of people coming laughing around you and giving you presents and cards and everything because you're going to die. But I'm only indicating a general thing, that the doctor, the ministers, the psychiatrists, and above all us, really owe it to our friends to work out an entirely new approach to death. Because what has happened, you see, from earliest childhood, the child learned that great uncle was dying and saw the family put on long faces and say, oh, that's too bad. Even Christians who think they're going to go to heaven, you know, they get absolutely morbid, more so than anybody else about death, because heaven, as they all know, is a very boring place. And so this frightful thing. Oh, he's dead, you know. Now one understands that for the living, to lose someone you love, or even for a dying person to worry about what on earth my wife, my children, my whatever are going to do without me. One can understand a certain worry in that. But nobody is indispensable. And there comes a point when you have to say, I'm sorry, but I am completely going to abandon responsibility for anything. Because there is no further way I can do it. This is another way of that surrender. And then the curious thing that occurs is the moment all that is dropped, suddenly it dawns on you. That to be important, existence does not have to go on any longer than a moment. Quantitative continuity is of no value. How long can you hold your breath? Who cares? So, it follows from that, you see, that if any one of us, without being shocked into it by being bombed or put in a concentration camp, could at this moment be as one about to die, genuinely and honestly, we would understand the mystery of life. Because death is the, in a certain sense, the source of life. Just as we see in nature, when the leaves fall from the trees, they mold and rot, and this supplies humus from which more plants can grow. It's a cycle like that. But in every way, symbolic and otherwise, human beings try to stop that cycle. Unamuno said, human beings are the only species that hoard their dead. And therefore, with the ghastly art of the mortician, we try to make the body unpalatable to the worms, and so to stop life, as if to be eaten in due course were an indignity to the human being. Whereas we eat everything else and we give nothing back. So that is a kind of a social symptom of our profound disorientation with respect to death. We think death is unnatural, and furthermore, in our culture, we think birth is a disease, and send a mama to the hospital for the most unnatural, weird kind of parturition. In other words, more and more one regards the healthy and inevitable and natural transformations of the body as pathological. I can imagine, you know, people having sexual intercourse on an operating table to be sure that the whole thing is hygienic. You know, everything about us like that is become over interfered with by specialists, and less the province of our own preferences. It's very, very hard indeed to die in your own way, without some blasted bunch of relatives come fussing around and insisting that you go to a hospital, that you get fixed with the tortures of being fed through tubes and things to keep you alive indefinitely and waste the family savings. It's even a crime to commit suicide. Now, this is simply nonsense. It's this perfect panic to survive at all costs. Now, let's get practical. You say, okay, I understand what you are saying theoretically. But I know that I would be terrified if somebody was going to tell me that I'm going to die. and that I would look frantically around for some doctor, some sort of something, that this panic to live is in us in an uncontrollable way, and this is part of the reason why we say we have an instinct to survive. The instinct is this panic. So let's take another step now, in the same way as I showed you steps about realizing that you don't have an ego. You say to yourself in the ordinary way, when you feel that panic, you feel a bit ashamed of it. Even though you've been taught that you should do everything possible to survive. See what a bind you're in here? So one feels, oh goodness, I must face this thing calmly and bravely and not be in this panic. But the point of the fact is, you are in a panic and you can't stop it. Now that's very important. Because this is another way of showing you the same thing that death is showing you, that you can't do anything about it. Just as when you finally realize you can't do anything about the death, you could have solved all that before by understanding you couldn't do anything about the panic. But if you think all the time, I'm supposed to stop this panic, then all that happens is you're at cross purposes with yourself again. The panic is, of course, put off in the ordinary way. We all know we're going to die. But it's sufficiently far off so that we can put it out of our minds. And anybody who does put it into our minds in the ordinary way is taken to be a skeleton at the banquet, a Cassandra, and gloomy. So that the old-fashioned preacher of bygone days who preached about death and those monks who kept skulls on their desks and all that sort of thing is regarded today as very morbid. Why, in the Baroque times, there was a fashion for a while of making tombstones with marvelous sculptures of skeletons and bones all over them. And on the Via Veneto in Rome, there is a Capuchin church, where down in the crypt there are chapels made where the altar furnishings and everything are made entirely from the bones of departed monks. Then we have in among Tibetans and in Buddhists graveyard meditations, and they have trumpets in Tibetan Buddhism made of human thigh bones, and they have cups, ritual cups, made of the domes of human skulls, richly worked in silver and turquoise. And we say all that is very morbid. So from this point of view, you can see, first of all, theoretically, how death can solve its own problem. Now, if you say, I can only see it theoretically, and I can't go the whole way with you, then I will ask you, what is blocking you? Will you say, it gives me the heebie-jeebies and the horrors? I say, all right, so death is not the problem, the heebie-jeebies is the problem. So let's deal with the heebie-jeebies in the same way as with death. You cannot stop the heebie-jeebies. You think you should. I say, don't. The heebie-jeebies are very valuable. Not that they will stop you from dying, but because from them you will learn the same thing as you would learn from dying. But the social pressure on you to resist the heebie-jeebies is terrific. Now, why must you do that? Why is everybody saying these heebie-jeebies, these fears, etc., are not permissible? You wonder about that. And the reasoning behind all that is not very clear, because it seems to be saying, well, if you have all these fears and things like that, you won't be a very good soldier. You won't be able to act competently in a crisis. You'll get the heebie-jeebies instead, and you won't know what to do. Well, nobody has ever really proved that. Because actually, people who we would call very courageous are, in fact, often quite frightened. And courageous action is not necessarily a consequence of having no fear. Sometimes it might be, but it isn't always so. The real reason why the heebie-jeebies are suppressed has more to do with its orgiastic aspects. Wherever the human organism gets into a certain kind of extreme, it starts an oscillating process going. Just as it does in sexual orgasm. And that oscillating process will inspire in others an emotion which they cannot identify either as disgust or as lust. They don't know quite what it is. All those extreme situations, terror, and as we shall see more, response to pain, have an orgiastic quality. And they are therefore embarrassing because they conflict with our image of ourselves as in control, composed, deported. That's in the sense of deportment. But it would be shameful, in a way, you might not want to look at your own face in a state of complete sexual rapture. As a matter of fact, if you saw a photograph of your face, you wouldn't be able to tell whether you were in pleasure or in pain. It might be either. Because then, you see, what has happened is that a tide, a vibration, a pulsation, has taken over the whole being. So that you are, as it were, in the possession of a god. And that's something taboo. So we begin here to move into a very difficult area. Because a lot of people were beginning to say, this conversation is getting out of line because we're moving into what are normally called perverse experiences. And the two critical forms of perverse experience are sadism and masochism, where there is the association of pain and ecstasy. In sadism, the confusion of another person's suffering with that person's sexual orgasm. In masochism, the identification, or if you want to say confusion, of your own suffering with sexual orgasm. Now we say, well, that's pathological, that's absurd. But it exists. People do it all the time, both ways, and sometimes both together. And although this is generally put under the heading of pathology, the fact remains that we can still learn something from it. There's an important principle in there, somehow, somewhere. And perhaps in people who are sadists and masochists, the phenomenon is somehow out of hand because they don't understand the principle. Now, do you realize many sadists want nothing more than that their victim should enjoy the pain?